Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. We are joined today by the writer, sociologist, lecturer and music critic, Keith Carne-Harris. His books include Judaism, All That Matters, Uncivil War, The Israel Conflict in the Jewish Community, Extreme Metal, Music and Culture on the Edge, and his latest book, Denial, The Unspeakable Truth, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Keith. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, well, maybe you could begin, Keith, by telling us perhaps a bit about yourself and what it was that prompted you to write the book.
Well, this book has a fairly long genesis, despite it being relatively short. It's a long essay or a short book, depending on how you view these things, depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, I guess. I first started thinking about these issues about 2006, 2007. And I always wanted it to be a non-academic book, part of my transition away from academic sociology to more public writing.
Yeah.
I worked up a proposal, had some interest in it with a mainstream publisher, but the editor couldn't get it past their editorial board.
Okay.
So in the end, after various to and fro, I dropped the proposal, but I always wanted to go back to it. And the same editor, by now working freelance, got back to me in 2017 and said, "Do you want to write this book, but for a different publisher, which is Notting Hill Editions?" And of course, I jumped at the chance. I think that the fact that the proposal was rejected 10 years ago and accepted 10 years later probably tells you something about the changing context within which debates about denial take place.
Yeah.
I think there was certainly a lot of interest in it 10 years ago. I think it was certainly recognized as a problem. But I think it's really been in the last two or three years, with all the interest in fake news, post-truth, and so on, that interest in it has extended to the point where it's seen as very high on the agenda. And I'm not saying that nobody wrote on this before me. Plenty of people did manage to get books accepted by publishers. But I think my history here is perhaps instructive in this regard.
So first of all, then, let's have a look at these terms, denial and denialism. And what do they both mean, and you know, how do they differ?
Well, denial is something that we all do. It's a normal process, at times anyway. It can become pathological, but it's essentially normal, in the sense that life in its full complexity and ourselves in our full complexity can be too difficult to face all the time without any kind of protection.
Yeah.
Denial is one of the ways human beings use to go on to in a world that is very difficult, in which we are a bundle of different desires, not all of which are necessarily socially appropriate. Yeah. So by denying things, we can clamp down on them and just interact socially and normally and be normal human beings. I don't like the term normal, by the way, but I think in this instance it's a useful shorthand. But of course it can become problematic. The classic example you can use would be an alcoholic who says they don't have a drink problem, but is hiding all their empty bottles under the sink or wherever. But for most of us, it is something that we simply need to do some of the time. Denialism is something different. Denialism is the turning of this everyday process of denial into a form of pseudo-scholarship, into ideology, into something that is institutional, robust, and worked out. it isn't simply denying that something is the case. It isn't just ignoring something, pretending it's not there. It is saying, this is not the case, but this is what's really the case. Denial is passive to a degree, whereas denialism is much more active. So one of the things that helped me make that distinction was a book by Carrie Marie Norgaard called, but it's a book, it's an ethnography, she's a sociologist, it's an ethnography of a Norwegian town conducted during an exceptionally warm winter in, I think, 2012 to 2013. And what she was talking about there was the denial that pervaded the town about global warming, in the sense that people more or less acknowledged it was going on, but find it very difficult to relate that acknowledged fact to what was actually going on in their small Norwegian town. But that was denial. They weren't coming up with counter-explanations as to why the town was getting warmer. Mm-hmm. Simply trying to pretend it wasn't there. But one of the things that Norgaard argues, though, is that everyday denial can be the basis, can provide the foundation for more work through forms of denialism that are much more pernicious, because denial, everyday denial, can be combated, although it's difficult, through education and awareness. I mean, you can stage an intervention with an alcoholic to say, no, look at these empty bottles under your sink. But denialism is much more robust and much more resistant to that kind of debunking.
Okay. Well, you mentioned anthropogenic climate change denial, and obviously there's Holocaust denial. But what other examples of denialism would you say are quite pernicious?
Well, Holocaust denial and anthropogenic climate change denial are the two most well-known examples, but others include, and it isn't always useful to call them denialism or denial. They have other names. So, for example, AIDS denialism is people denying that AIDS exists or that HIV causes AIDS. There's creation science, which is denial of evolution, coming up with pseudoscientific explanations that claim to show that there is a designer behind the world. Indeed, one offshoot of it is called intelligent design theory. Yeah. There's the anti-vaccine movement, which uses a lot of denialist techniques. But more broadly, denialist techniques are used in a wide range of areas. In fact, they can be used for any kind of purpose, really. One of the things I say, and this echoes what a lot of other people have written about it, is that denialism, the way you spot denialism is by the use of particular sorts of argumentative techniques. And they're there for everyone to use. After all, you can make a bad case for a good argument. We're all capable of doing that.
Okay, I suppose in the Middle Way Society, two of the telltale signs of what we describe as absolute thinking is when a belief can't be incrementalized, or that it's not open to alternatives, which we call provisionality. Would that relate to denialism too?
Possibly. I mean, I think I'd probably need to know a little bit more about what you're talking about. Can you say a little more about that?
Okay, well, say, for example, an absolute belief is a belief in the, you know, in infinite and all-knowing God. You can't really, you either believe that or you don't. So for example, science generally deals in probabilities. So you talk in incremental terms about the degree of confidence that you have in a certain hypothesis or theory. I'm extremely confident that I'm talking to you at the moment, not having a lucid dream, but, you know, I can't be absolutely certain that's the case. So I'm in that sense, I'm thinking incrementally rather than absolutely. And the other side of it is that this idea that a belief is absolute when you're not willing to consider alternatives. So it's almost like a something that you cultivate, a sensibility of provisionality.
Yes, I think that sounds like quite a useful way to approach it. I think that, of course, you can be dogmatic about things that are correct, as I say. Yeah. You know, but the scientific method, at best, what you call provisionality, is really a description of what scientific research and discovery should be at its best. It isn't always, but should at its best, which is that you develop theories that explain as much as possible at the time, but that can, in theory at least, be open to revision over time. The classic example about this is the replacement of Newtonian mechanics with Einstein's theories.
Exactly.
And what Einstein did wasn't to show that Newton was quote-unquote wrong, because he wasn't wrong. What Einstein did was to show that Newton's theories worked in certain contexts, but not in others. Theories could explain things that Newton's theories couldn't. So that's how science works at its best. And you know, and that is one thing that denialists tend to argue is they sort of make the counter-accusation that what they are trying to deny is dogma. So you'll see this a lot with climate change denialists, who will say that climate change is a new religion, is a new dogma. But in fact, and of course, it has to be said that some proponents of action on climate change do make dogmatic claims. But the better climate change scientists make the claims more modestly. They say, given our observations, given our models, this is the best explanation we have for what is going on. And one of the many reasons why the climate change denialism doesn't work is because it doesn't provide a better explanation than that of anthropogenic climate change that fits human observations.
No, that makes a lot of sense, Keith. Also, people often associate skepticism or balanced skepticism with denial, but this to me is a misunderstanding of skeptical arguments, and it probably arises because no is ambiguous. For example, someone saying no to a claim by somebody else may be asserting the opposite, or they may simply be failing to accept the claim that's being made. So to what degree might this play a role in understanding this topic?
I think I think you're right about that. I think that there is a big problem generally in how we talk about knowledge and science. I think there's certainly a problem in how we talk about skepticism and doubt. One of the things that you can say of some denialists, and I stress some, is that some denialists are people who have practiced skepticism over assiduously to the point of questioning things beyond the point where a reasonable person should be satisfied. But the difference between those and other denialists is those people eventually usually come round. So there was, within the skeptic movement in America, there's a guy called Michael Shermer, who has been he wrote a book debunking Holocaust denial. He's written books debunking all sorts of scientific claims, pseudoscientific claims. But it took him a very, very long time. He was very skeptical about anthropogenic climate change to the point of almost embracing denialism on it. But he backed away from it because at the end, he was too good a scientist not to, if you like. However, it was difficult for him to do that. The other thing that I think is problematic about skepticism is we are living in an age of incredibly intricate, minute subspecialties. We are long past the point, as we were maybe 2-3 centuries ago, where a highly educated person could have something to say about a vast array of different fields, like people did in the Enlightenment. Instead, to study climate change is difficult enough because it requires bringing together specialisms that are often very separate from each other. For example, glaciology, evidence from the weather, evidence from gases in the atmosphere, and so on. One of the things that denialists generally do is they kind of take the power back. In an age in which people have been radically disempowered by expert discourses that have developed beyond the point where anyone other than specialists can understand them, denialists are claiming their right to be skeptics, to be polymaths, in essence. that these things are available to everybody who has the determination, and you don't need a PhD or a lifetime of research experience to intervene in debates on things like climate change. And you can see why that's attractive.
Yeah.
You can see why that's something that many people would like to partake in, because it's quite empowering.
You mentioned debunking just then. You say in the book that's normally the most common response to denialism, but you suggest that's also problematic. Could you just unpack that a bit?
Well, the problem with debunking, first of all, to say that debunking denialist claims is essential. It's essential partly because you cannot let bad science, bad scholarship stand.
Yeah.
It would simply be an outrage for that to be the case. It's also essential for people who might be wavering, who might be open-minded enough to weigh both cases. But for most people who embrace denialism, it's not effective, or people are predisposed to embrace it. It's not effective. And that's because some very powerful psychological processes are at work here, driving denialism, which is, and I talk about this in the book, a desire for something not to be true, because for something to be true that threatens something essential within oneself, one's ideology or commitments or history or whatever it is. And the human mind has very powerful mechanisms that resist that. And so simply pointing out you're wrong and this is why rarely has the intended effect. Indeed, some psychologists have talked about what's known as the backfire effect, which is that debunking can actually strengthen beliefs rather than undermine them.
Is that another word for cognitive dissonance, or is it something similar to that?
Well, it's not the same thing, but I think it's in the same territory, in the sense that one central preoccupation of psychology in recent decades has been why do people not change their mind? Why are we not purely rational beings? How do we make decisions? And it seems fairly inescapable that the model of the reasoning individual who could simply weigh things in a disinterested way is most certainly the exception rather than the rule,
which
leads to all sorts of problems, because it leads to doubt and insecurity. You start thinking, well, what if they're right and I'm wrong? What if I'm simply protecting my own beliefs? So it's a very difficult thing.
So then, presumably, to some extent, you say this is a phenomenon of human psychology, then it's always existed. But has it become more prevalent due to certain factors in modernity that enables it?
I think it's become, denialism to a degree has always been with us, but nothing along on even anything approaching the scale that happened in modernity. There are two things that happens in modernity, in the modern world, dating from, depending on how you date it, from the 17th, 18th century onwards. One is the emergence of science as the prestige discourse, as the way in which you legitimate our ideas. We've all swallowed the idea that we have to be rational, reasoning individuals, and therefore to have science on your side is the ultimate prize, really, in political and other arguments. And one of the things denialism does is it far from being anti-science, it adopts that prestige language for its own purposes. So that's one tendency. The other is, what I argue in the book, is that in modernity, some things that human beings have always done became what I call unspeakable. You could not speak of them in public. So, for example, genocide is something that has happened throughout human history. And it happens in modernity too, but the difference is it is not something that can be publicly legitimated anymore. There is no language with which to do it. Similarly, venality, looting countries, doing things that cause multiple human suffering. These sorts of things, we still want to do them, but we don't have a language with which to talk of them. And so denialism starts to solve that problem. It kind of predicts those desires from being revealed. it allows you to retain your desires that you cannot speak of publicly and legitimate them through scientific means.
You mentioned earlier on certain denialist techniques. What are the most common ones?
Well, one thing that debunkers have a lot of fun with is coming up with taxonomies of denialism. Somebody called Mark Hufnagel once put together what he called the denialist deck of cards, which was a list of deck of cards with a different denialist technique in them. But I argue that they boil down into a number of commonly used ones, one of them which is focusing on minute details. So, for example, you don't argue the whole argument that the gas chambers didn't exist. You argue about what an aerial photograph of the placing of the chimneys in Auschwitz tells you, and it becomes focused down on something minute, because you can't win the whole argument, but you might be able to win, or at least create the appearance of winning, something very minute. Yeah. Similarly, climate change denialists try and focus down on polar bear populations in the Arctic. Croatian scientists often talk about the complexity of the human eye.
Yeah.
So focusing on these minutiae sort of makes the project a little bit more, it levels the playing field to a degree. Another thing that denialists do is engage in conspiracy theory, because one of the things they have to explain is, okay, if you're right, then why do most people say you're wrong? And usually the answer to that is some kind of conspiracy. But conspiracies that are usually so vast as to be unbelievable or to involve some kind of psychic process that nobody has ever identified. So, for example, in Holocaust denial, if Holocaust denial is correct, then it means there are several million Jews, people in the world, that were not killed and have somehow been embroiled in a conspiracy to conceal their very existence from the world, which would be massive if it were true, of course. It is not true. But there are various other techniques as well. So, for example, bombarding people with claims but not giving you a chance to refute them, various other things like that.
Okay. What do you mean by the gap?
So my book, I talk about, this goes back to what I talk about modernity, which is I talk about the gap between desires that we might have and our ability to publicly speak of them. So if you are someone who thinks, I think industrialized capitalism, carbon-fueled capitalism, is so precious that it is worth preserving, even at the cost of the suffering that climate change will cause, there's really no way of saying that, or at least it's very difficult to say it, to make that argument. So there's a gap between the desire that is motivating it and what you can actually say publicly. This is a wider issue of modernity as well, that there is I suggest that that gap to some extent has always been with us. It's not easy for human beings to say what it is they really want. But I think the possibilities in the pre-modern age were larger than they are now. It was possible for a king to loot his country and do things for his own glory, and feel okay about it and say, yes, this is what I've done. It's not possible for a president to do it now, however rapacious, or a prime minister or whoever.
Yeah, okay. And then you talk about the denier's alternative.
So this is pretty dark. I'm basically putting it out there to say to denialists, well, it doesn't have to be this way. You could make the case for the genocide of Jews, for the drowning of Bangladesh, for all these sorts of things. And I laid it out in the book saying this is what it would look like. And I did it through denialist's own words, because one of the things that you often find in denialist discourse is they come very close to acknowledgement. And by putting all those moments that are close to acknowledgement together, I try to say this is what your alternative is. You could do otherwise. Not to say that I necessarily welcome that alternative, but I'm saying that I'm trying to put the enormity of the problem out there by saying that the alternative to denialism isn't a world that is sweetness and light. The alternative to denialism is something that's actually quite unpleasant.
And then in the next chapter, it actually gets even darker potentially, because you talk about the potential of a post-denialist age where denialists no longer feel to not speak the unspeakable truth.
So what I call post-denialism is kind of a step towards that open acknowledgement, towards the denier's alternative. And we're seeing this particularly with Donald Trump, who kind of embraces denialism, but in a very lackluster and lazy sort of way. He's, you know, he doesn't pretend to be a scholar. He doesn't pretend to have truth and justice on their side. It's basically he says the truth is what he says is the truth. It's abandoning the kind of discipline that you find in denialism as it traditionally was, to the point where the very idea of truth is being undermined itself. And that is getting these sorts of people much closer to that acknowledgement.
How concerned are you?
Well, yeah, I am very concerned. It is a scary moment, clearly. And I don't welcome a time when people will be able to advocate fully for all sorts of terrible things. But it may be a painful necessity, as I argue in the book. It may be that, because we don't really argue that genocide is bad. We just assume it's bad.
Yeah.
We've let our ability to argue against certain things wither by making all sorts of assumptions, modern assumptions about what something bad is. And I think we're going to have to get better at it. Yeah. If we want to get out of the present moment, we're going to have to say, okay, climate change is going to lead to horrific suffering in places like Bangladesh. And this is why you should care. This is why it's wrong.
Yeah.
Rather just assuming that making that argument that Bangladesh is going to drown is necessarily going to press everybody, because it's quite clear that it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm just thinking, though, this raises to me another question. Should we publicly debate denialists? I don't know if you saw that film that came out recently with Rachel Weisz and Timothy Spall called Denial.
By
David Irving. A central theme there was that the protagonist refuses to publicly debate with David Irving. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would agree with her. I don't think there's anything productive about treating denialists as the other side in a legitimate scholarly debate. I don't think that takes us anywhere, and I think it's dangerous. However, I do leave space in the book for a different kind of debate, and it's, I don't necessarily want to do it. I'm putting it out there, and I'm not sure I necessarily want it, but I'm saying that it might be more productive to have a debate, however horrendous it would be, with someone like David Irving, if he were to say what it is he really wants, to say on the legitimacy of genocide as a political tool.
Right.
That is something that we should at least make a notional possibility for, because the fact is, denialists talk about free speech, but they aren't speaking freely.
Yeah.
And it may be that if we want to wean denialists off that, we have to open that invitation for them, which is to say, if you will speak freely of what it is you really want, then we will debate with you. But yeah. Again, I'm not entirely 100% sold on my argument, but I am putting it out there for debate and discussion, because I think these are issues that need to be talked about.
Sure, no, that's very interesting. And are there any other responses?
Well, I think some research has shown that it is possible to, quote-unquote, inoculate people against denialism. That if you get people at an early off stage teaching people critical thinking, scientific method, that it might be possible to get people to resist this. And I think that's certainly true. Certainly when I think about the scientific education I had at school, it didn't really teach those sorts of thinking techniques at all.
Yeah.
And I think that that would, I mean, implicitly, I suppose it suggested them, but it didn't really engage with that sort of thing. And I think there's research has shown that there is some mileage in this sort of thing. And also, if you are prepared to do the work, very long, arduous processes of very, very careful dialogue can, in some cases, wean people off denialist arguments. Generally not the people who are propagating those arguments, but perhaps people who are receptive to them.
Yeah.
So there is at least a modicum of hope, but there should be no doubting the difficulty of the task.
Just on that subject of critical thinking, someone I interviewed a while back has done this research suggesting that the education and intelligence are no safeguard against blinkered thinking. Often, because you have the articulacy, you can often argue your way out of cognitive dissonance or the backfire effect or whatever you want to call it. What seems crucial to more open thinking is curiosity and an openness to being wrong. So while critical thinking is really important, do you think it would also be helpful that certain emotional skills be taught in schools, like meditation, for example, or mindfulness, for example, so where you learn to sit with your experience and respond to it rather than simply react to it? And then with those two things combined, that would help.
I think things like mindfulness and meditation can play a part in education. I don't think any one thing is a panacea necessarily.
Oh, no, me neither.
And I think things like meditation and mindfulness, I don't think necessarily guard against things like denialism, but they're worthy for different reasons. So I'm not entirely sure about that argument, yeah. But I would be happy to be convinced otherwise.
Yeah, I suppose I think it's about approaching the problem from various positions. So, for example, mindfulness is is just one thing, and of course critical thinking and engagement with politics, as you say, dialogue, but also perhaps engagement with the arts as well, you know, and all these forms of integrative practices for me seem to be helpful in keeping a more open critical position on things.
Well, I think they certainly can help with coming to terms with desire, yeah, or at least finding a way of engaging with it. Yeah. And they can help in sort of self-knowledge and self-acceptance, some of which does drive denialism. So, yes, I think that can certainly play a part.
The middle way, it's a questionnaire I always ask people at the end of the talks, Keith. The middle way, as we understand it, is the idea that if you avoid fixed dogmatic beliefs about things, that throws you back into the sort of messy, uncertain world of experience. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain world of experience we can perhaps get to grips more adequately with the phenomena we encounter, whatever they are. So how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I like that idea a great deal. I like embracing messiness and complexity and avoiding dogmatism. It isn't something that is 100% possible, but it certainly works as an ideal. It's not possible to be completely neutral. It's not possible to be completely in the middle. We all have desires and ideals, and rightly so. But certainly cultivating a sense of doubt, a sense and a tolerance for complexity is good for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, I fully endorse everything you said there. Yeah. Okay, my last question, Keith. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Thanks for the opportunity to plug my book. So my book is now available. It's called Denial, The Unspeakable Truth. The publisher is Notting Hill Editions. It's available online in the usual places as well as from the publisher. More generally, if you're interested about me, I have a website, con-harris.org, and you can find me on Twitter fairly easily as well. So, yes, I'd be happy to hear from listeners.
Great. Okay, well, I'd just like to say that, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. And just going back to what you said at the beginning, I found it really accessible, you know, not dumbed down, but I found you managed to unpack some quite difficult concepts and made them very digestible. And I thought it was very insightful too, and very informative. So from my position, I'd highly recommend it. Anyway, well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Keith. It's been really interesting and a pleasure.
Thank you too, and please let me know when the podcast is live.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.